I would be really happy to first welcome you to the EBVS podcast, but also to ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Well, thank you. It is my honor. So thank you very much for having me. I'm Alice Diana. I'm an Italian veterinarian. I dabbled a little bit in clinical practice before starting to work at FVE, so the Federation of Veterinarians of Europe, and we're currently in its office in Brussels. And I work here as a policy officer. Not what I had planned, I think, during my studies, but where I'm at. And that's also how you and I met, because of all the good work we do on veterinary education.
Exactly. So we met through the ECCVT, which is the European Coordinating Committee on Veterinary Training.
Yeah.
And as happens, we struck up a few conversations that were more relevant to our individual paths. And that's kind of how we stumbled across this episode.
Yes. Yes. We have some like-minded ideas on topics that are a bit under-discussed in the veterinary profession and community. So, like, when you offered the opportunity to discuss this, not just between the two of us, I hope this speaks to someone else too. Like, it's not just the two of us striking that chord.
I'm pretty sure that it's not just the two of us.
Good.
But I think then, you know, without further ado, we can already just dive into those topics maybe. And I have them here in front of me, so people may notice that I'm relating to a list of questions, but I think we'll power through. So one of the things that we've discussed, Alicia, more than once, is you kind of came to consider in recent months or over the last year maybe, potentially pursuing specialization as a veterinarian, and that wasn't coming right out of graduation or an internship, which is maybe not the traditional pathway that we think of. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, what was it that influenced you to maybe start considering that?
Yeah, so I think you knocked the nail right on the head. So I was never even considering doing a specialization, because even when I was in clinical practice, I didn't have a need or a drive to be a specialist. And then I think this is somewhere where you might have also noticed the gap. There's not as much knowledge of non-clinical specializations. So I had no idea that there were these other colleges as options. But a residency might work, because a lot of what we do here is still relevant to my field of interest, which is, spoiler, the College of Veterinary Public Health. And when I started looking into it, I was like, wow, this really aligns with my interest, as I like my passion is the One Health approach, and so both the subspecialty of population medicine and food safety really fit into that well. But I didn't know this was at all an option. I didn't know there could be specializing programs in non-clinical fields. And once I saw that option, I started realizing how much that could maybe push my knowledge into a direction of being an expert in this, and how, especially in the policy space, being an expert on this can be mean more than being just a lobbyist with the institutions, but actually provide technical consulting and advisory roles, which is somewhere we don't imagine ourselves as vets, and somewhere where I feel like I could really contribute with the proper background and the proper training. So that's where I really started looking into it. And the more I did, I got very excited, but I was also a bit concerned of how will this work with me already having a job. Okay, how does this structure work for me? But so I started seeing the residency program as an opportunity for me to really become an expert in a field I'm passionate about, and a field where I did not get much training in my veterinary education, because besides the fact that I thought of myself as a clinician until like the very end of my studies, and so I didn't even try to target maybe electives and other opportunities that would advance my skill set towards working in policy. Even if I had, I don't think I would have had that much opportunity to do that. And so I was already at a point where I'm launching myself just as a vet in this policy space, where I know nothing about the system, the structure, the institutions, how this is all done. So learning more about that in a structured program that maybe is not meant to teach me about policy, but a program that leaves me the freedom to shape it that way, felt very exciting. So that's where I'm at, where I would love to unite my passion for veterinary fields in like a career path that is a little more unorthodox for our profession, but still is very much aligned. It's just we've never put ourselves in those spaces. And I hope the residency and being a diplomat will really, you know, kind of make that all happen, kind of set the stones in place, because it's kind of, I have a bit of a vision, vaguely, I'm not sure if it's where I'm going to go, but I don't have any delineated path ahead of me at all, because I don't know many people that have this ambition and have this drive, mm-hmm. and so I need to kind of make my own way, and right now the residency sounds like a way to maybe get myself there. No certainties, but there's a lot of potential there.
Well, and I think there's a couple of threads for this conversation that are just so resonant right now for where EBVS is at. We'll have to take them one at a time, obviously. So hopefully we loop back. But one piece is, you know, having that flexibility to sort of design a program that fits your needs around having a job, around having sort of a niche, or in some ways niche, in some ways extremely broad.
Absolutely.
Set of skills coming out, what you hope to get out of the residency because it's policy oriented. I think these are really points that support the EBVS initiative of flexible pathways.
Absolutely.
And, you know, in early days, and even still, there's sometimes a conversation around how do we know that the quality can still be maintained? But listening to you talk about, you know, embracing the fact that there's no known path to do what you want to do, that sounds very aware of knowing that that means there's extra amount of responsibility. Sounds a little heavy, but
it
self-leadership.
Is in some way. Like, I will need to craft my own path, and whether it works or not is, yes, it's dependent on the offer that is available where I will do the residency, but also dependent on me taking up opportunities and creating opportunities for myself. So it's great that the framework allows people to bring in their own opportunities that are not just like, okay, this university has these courses you can follow, and you can really bring everything you want to the table within, of course, as long as it's relevant. But having the power to shape it is such a strength, but also a risk, of course.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we've learned with the colleges that have implemented FlexPath, is that it's a lot of ownership around your own process. And I was actually talking with a couple of cardiologists, I think it was last week, and they said, you know, we've come to think of flexible pathways as badass. Like, originally, there were quality concerns, but when you really think about it, there's so much onus on the person doing it for themselves as the trainee that it's just badass. And I thought that was a very apt description, and I like the way that you're very open-eyed approaching it, knowing that what you want to get out of it is maybe unorthodox, but also very inspired, very motivating for you. Is that a fair way of describing it?
I think it is. I think if it were too much of a closed box, I would not see as much of the appeal to it. In all honesty, like, even for the scope of the topics I'm interested, even if it were very... Because also my topic, my interest is very interdisciplinary within the veterinary profession, maybe not just sticking to what is strictly veterinary. If the program were too rigid, it might not be right for me. I would feel like I need to stick within, like, draw within the lines. And having that space is what made me think, okay, this can be right for me because I can shape it the way I want it to be. Whether it's flex or not, like, within the, like, getting very concrete, the activity log, there is quite a bit of freedom. And that is very exciting for me because even in my day job or any job I've done so far, you know, you're not driving your own path so much. Like, of course, you try to align... You try to find a job that aligns with you. But there are some limits. And this is a very rare opportunity to have this much freedom, I think. I mean, I don't know in concrete. This is how it appears so far, of course. But that is what really, I think, drove the excitement the shaping it, while aligning it, also like drawing in what makes me excited about these fields and making it happen in a way that works towards my direction.
So we didn't specifically talk about this question in advance, but now I'm curious. What would you say is the value that you see a specialist title offering you?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair question?
The whole thing is, it's very clear what a clinical specialist can do. And what a non-clinical specialist can do, not as much. It's not written in stone, which again works with me not having a clear vision, but also keeps that vision clear in some way. So I don't think in the specific college I'm looking at, there is a written path of what I can do with it. And I also don't know how much recognition there is of having that that title, let's say, added to my name. So I'm really not looking at what doors will this open, because it will or it might not. And having that hope might be disappointing, but more so of the process that gets me there and the skill set and knowledge that I will have as me and not just as a specialist, and what I will be able to bring to future Alice working in whatever it is that happens at that point. And so it's really about the process and not about the title. The title, of course, is exciting too, because I do hope that it is recognized. I do hope that being a specialist will mean that I am considered an expert in my given field. But it's really about actually having that expertise. And that's where I have confidence in the... It's that's kind of your mission, you know, like making the title matter.
Mm-hmm.
But something where you don't need to strive as much and you already know you have is making the knowledge and like that, like delivering the knowledge and the confidence. Well, not the confidence. We had this conversation yesterday. Delivering the knowledge and the skill set to the residents that are then diplomats, like the confidence in what the diplomats have, that is not as much up in the air. And that's, you know, that's what I'm going for. So I don't know if that exactly answers what you asked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is just a conversation. There's no right answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and this kind of still is in the thread of the idea of the flexible pathway, but I think giving people examples of why that accessibility needs to be available, but also, you know, highlighting why some of those needs are important, you know, like being able to do a residency while you have another job, or maybe somebody who wants to have a family, being able to do a residency while still starting a young family. I mean, the list is endless, right? You know, you travel for your job a lot, probably. I travel a lot for my job. You know, having those sorts of freedoms in the flexibility, I think, is an access point that we've kind of discussed. Also around potentially increasing the diversity that we see in the veterinary profession in Europe. And one of the things that we've talked a little bit about is that there are also invisible exclusivities or lack of inclusivity is probably a better way of describing that, around, you know, socioeconomic status. Of course, we all think of gender. What do you see, particularly as a younger voice in veterinary medicine than myself, what do you see as potentials to increase the motivation of females in leadership, but also all of these other factors that we sometimes don't see as much of in Europe in veterinary medicine?
I think like the flexibility, like you already said, is definitely a crucial point. Of course, motherhood immediately comes to mind. So having all the options to focus on career and focusing on motherhood and focusing on having time, mobility, and non-discriminatory workplaces should fit all together. It's not just dependent on one person. So like the support network, family, friends, is something that is completely independent and kind of out of the scope of what we're saying. But it's really hard, like besides these obvious sides, which are, as you said, visible, and flexibility will cater to more and allow more accessibility towards, I'm also thinking of the less visible things, whereas as neurodivergence, some kind of diverse mobility and other disabilities and different orientation, which is not really a hindrance in the work, in the work, but more so in the acceptance, mm-hmm. in the community, mm-hmm. and in the fields. And these are invisible things, like anyone you will interview probably has more diversity in them than will show up in the podcast, and more than they will say, as it gets personalized. It's not something you even need to know as a colleague, a client, or a resident supervisor. But it should be there, and I guess the flexibility is a big part, but also having tools that allow access, so, and the visibility that people are there. So in FEE and in VetJoy, the DI is something I'm really trying to imbue, and it's really hard with the invisible part. It's just about the openness and the access and the flexibility. It's a really hard question to answer.
I see two maybe access points. One is, I think if we got more comfortable discussing it, not from a perspective of going out and asking people, what type of diversity are you? That would be invasive. But just being able to sit down and have a conversation and say, you know what? I don't know about these experiences, and that's okay. Sure. And I would like to still be open to them. Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas just trying to be open-minded and just being willing to be there for the conversation and having more awareness around the fact that we as a profession are probably more diverse than we realize, particularly on the invisibility factor side. But also another thing that I really like to offer, I guess, if I can say it like that, is being an example. You know, there are scientific studies that show across the board, not respective to veterinary medicine, that women are less likely to nominate themselves for leadership roles.
So yeah, like the openness and the acceptance on both sides of someone is trying to be open, and that also requires a little bit of curiosity. It sometimes may become a little bit of prying, but that's the way they will know better and be more aware next time. So there needs to be acceptance on both sides of the process that gets us to awareness, that gets us to welcoming. And I really, really mean it on both sides, and I see it in myself too, that there are things that I'm a lot more aware and of, and the other things I need to more exposure and understanding for. And then there's the things that we have in ourselves already, like it's not so much of an investigating and understanding with others. So as you said, like being woman, being in leadership, being also somewhere you're not from, like being a non-native, being not in your first, like speaking every day, not in your first language, completely different culture. Like these are all hurdles that, like you didn't even mention those, but those are things are really peculiarities or view that you've championed and that you take around with you every day. And at this point, like you don't even consider them, but they're something that we need to showcase because it is possible. So, yes, of course, in our case, we're coming from countries that would be considered global north, but even just saying, you know, you can be anywhere in the world, and yes, language is a barrier, but with beyond that, the willingness and the knowledge that will get you there, then you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something else that you didn't even mention that we both showcase. So like being females in career paths we didn't imagine ourselves on somewhere else in the world, in another language. Well, right now we're speaking English, but okay, it's not my first language.
Yeah.
But that's so many things we're not prepared for, to do a career we didn't study for, in a country we don't know, in a culture and language that is not familiar to us, in a society that is even less ready than we are for it. And so all of that requires so much resilience and so much vision just to stay on that path, because there's so many times you can choose, like, it'd be so easy to just stay in Italy as a clinician. There's need for it. I could be happy. but could I thrive and maybe do more in something that impacts more the profession? And if that's somewhere I can go, but I have no examples of someone else who's doing this, I have no clear way ahead, like as we mentioned, I have no path set out for me. Does me setting out this path mean the next person has a little more ease because they don't need to do it all from zero?
Mm-hmm.
And has an example of, okay, there are vets in this role. There is a way to be a vet in policy. And adding to that, you know, all these other hurdles is something we can be very proud of and can, you know, can contribute to more awareness that it can be done. And adding that, the leadership aspect. So I'm lucky that I'm in a workplace that is almost entirely women, as most vets are actually nowadays. But so this aspect that you talked about, that there are so many vets that are women, but then the visibility and the what we consider experts, who we consider at the top of their field, and who are the, you know, the spokespeople, is mostly men. And so there's a gap there that I don't know how much it is of women not taking opportunities and also not women not being able to access these roles. And so the study you've read, there must be fundamental to the fact that it's women also not taking opportunities, but there's also a society that is not very welcome to us being in that place.
Well, and two, I think there's so many, I have so many thoughts, and I really like these conversations because that's where you really get in deep and start to look for ways to start a ripple effect, I think. And one of the things that I found, I was looking for content to put on EBVS's social media. I was really hoping to find something to kind of inspire bottom-up change. And I did find something. I found an article, which I can't remember the reference off the top of my head, if I'm honest. But it said that if you want to affect social change, all you actually need to start tipping the scale towards inevitable change at a cultural level, say in a workplace or in a profession or in whatever societal compartment you're dealing with, is you need 25% of like the bottom up to start tipping it, start the domino effect, essentially. And so what I tried to achieve with that post on our social media was it was meant for workplaces. You know, like if you felt like you didn't have agency in your workplace, then look for 25% of people to agree with you on one aspect that you wanted to influence, right? And I think that's probably a legitimate option across a lot of different things that need to be at least talked about. They need to at least be open conversations, right? And so I think when we look at the dynamic of gender leadership in the profession, it is delicate.
It is.
And I certainly don't want to convey that female leadership is better than male leadership,
or vice versa. Absolutely.
I think that we have complementary strengths in a lot of ways. And of course, there's also fluidity there, right? So from my perspective, what I hope to achieve by a sort of lead by example approach, being a female who is relatively visible in my role, is one, it is available. And two, hopefully, it's about knowing what my strengths are and what value I bring to the table. So I was telling you a story about somebody who said to me that one of our projects that we interacted on was sort of a turning point for her in feeling confident in speaking up for herself as a female practitioner. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I immediately could not avoid noticing about you is you have a seat at the table, you're a younger voice, you're female, but you're always there contributing and you are not scared to speak up. And I would love if that is a piece that we can start to change is I don't really care who you are. sitting at the table. I don't care if you're male, female, or other, non-binary. As long as you're speaking up in a, you know, open and constructive way, then why not? If you want to sit at the table, then come and bring your voice.
It is, I fully agree with that. I also really understand, like, when you feel like you barely got a foot in and you barely should have, like, you're barely worthy of a seat at the table, if you're too loud, maybe you lose your seat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that oftentimes, so now I'm a bit in a different role, so I have, luckily, through my position, I still have an opportunity to represent FEE. And sometimes what I've seen is maybe I'm at events with some IVSA representatives. So me, just a couple years ago, but I'm on the other side, you know, now, and they're not. And so I feel a little more empowered to speak up. Often we're between colleagues, and the students are like, "Oh, but I'm just a student. I don't have a voice." And I see that. I don't know if I was like that a couple years ago, but I see that. Also in our meetings, you see that the age factor, but also the status factor, hinders you from, okay, I'll put up my hand and I'll just speak up, rather than they'll call me out if they want the student perspective. And you don't feel like you can comment unless it's because they're asking for a student perspective. And that is really sad. And I understand it, but it's if you have a seat at a table, make the most of that table. You don't know if you'll have another table. And maybe, of course, sensitive things, I mean, it will be a trade-off, how much you give and what you give. But maybe because of your contribution at the table, you'd be at another table, rather than just seeing it as, I'll be off the table because I was loud.
Yeah, I think it's such a good point. I remember, you know, not even 10 years ago in my career, I was leading a service then as a surgeon. I was such an insecure person. I almost never spoke up. Obviously, that had nothing to do with patient advocacy. My patient was my patient, and I was going to advocate for them no matter what.
For yourself.
For myself, or you know, in whatever team decisions we were making as far as, you know, operational or day-to-day business, non-patient related decisions. And I had to learn it when I was doing a startup. One of our early investors was very impact driven, and he was not an easy person to work with, but I'm very thankful for those years of complex stakeholder management, because he taught me very early on, if you're not going to make this change, then who's going to make it? If you know that the world needs it, it doesn't matter if it's a big change or a small change. If you know that the world needs to change, but you're not willing to risk making it, then how can you expect anybody else to do it?
Absolutely.
And suddenly, speaking up became not about taking a risk of myself, but about the bigger risk of, well, what if no one ever tries this, you know? So what else is it that we're missing?
That's insane.
You know, like, what small risk could we take for the greater good instead of worrying about, do we have enough value to bring to the table?
And the worry is valid and the worry is legitimate, but we will need to take the risk at one point, or we'll just stay in the worry.
Yeah.
And that's where youth need to take up space. And that's the only way we're going to be included in conversation. It's not because we're going to be allowed a seat at the table. We're going to have to take that seat at the table. Whether it's in our profession, in our advocacy, I feel really strongly about that.
Well, and I think, too, one of the things that I've really appreciated about working with you is that you own your seat at the table without fighting for it. And by that I mean, like, you speak up when you have something to say. You're quite confident. You come off very confidently without feeling arrogant. But you're not trying to talk over everybody. You still listen. You're still curious about the experience in the room. So it's not about, when we talk about taking up space, I feel like sometimes that can create misunderstandings.
That
it's about sharing the space that's there, right? And I think that that's something I have always appreciated that you do well, is yes, you take up your space, but not at the expense of other people's space in the room. So it becomes a constructive, additive thing, as opposed to, I mean, when we're working in the committees or whenever we overlap, it never, in my experience, has in any way felt confrontational. It always feels additive.
Well, first of all, that's really, really lovely of you to say, and great to hear. Because you never know, like, the kind of energy you're putting out there. There's an intent, but then you don't really perceive it as neutrally as everyone else does. So that's lovely. Thank you. But I do believe already representation and visibility and just showing you can claim a space. And in some way, maybe this approach of just claiming it and confidently feeling like it's mine, make it look like she should be there. Like, she's just contributing. Like, why wouldn't there be a space for her to contributing?
Exactly.
Is actually, in the long, maybe it's more playing the long game, but working towards creating that space rather than having to fight tooth and nail to then become someone who's seen as just an advocate and an activist and not, you know, there is something
contributing value.
Not contributing value.
Inherently.
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be, like, taking up space does not need to be destructive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, that's not something that's exclusive to youth or any gender within veterinary medicine,
sure.
Right?
But we're not really taught about communicating
because
within our fields, we're maybe used to having the same level of expertise. And so we're used to speaking at the same level and register. And suddenly, when we're out of these rooms, and so whether it's an investor, but it's the general public, it's policymakers, and so they have a completely different experience and take on these topics, farmers, like, whatsoever, we're so used to what we, how we speak, but something that vets and people in science and research and so many like-minded professionals struggle with, I think, is then sending this, like, we have so much value, but we cannot deliver it because the communication is, like, the very last step, and that's where we stop. So, like, 99% of the effort is made, but because we fill in the communication, then it all goes nowhere.
And I think, too, you know, some of the communication, it's not always, sometimes it is the words that you use, but sometimes it's nonverbal communication,
yeah.
And I think this comes back to, it's easy for misperception to change a conversation from constructive to destructive. And I think this probably happens also, you know, on an individual level.
Absolutely.
We're constantly bombarded by perceptions that we are not even necessarily conscious of. And I think that that's part of the way that these roundtable committees ideally work, you know, is that we come, doesn't matter who you are, curious, listening, actively listening, that one I'm passionate about as well, and contributing value to the subject at hand without relying on, okay, well, I have these titles or I have this experience. Like, everyone is at the table. Let's all talk.
I think there's definitely something there. And because of, you know, how you started this whole direction we took now with the conversation on the way I present myself and the way I interact, like, if I had the same contributions but I presented myself in a completely different way, how far would it go? So it is really about, like, the nonverbal, the listening, just the energy, the attitude, the patience. 'Cause it would be great not having to overthink everything and just, you know, be natural, be comfortable, and the conversation just goes. But there needs to be a little work there.
So one of the things that we definitely wanted to come back and is come back to and is on our list of brainstorming is, you know, we've talked a lot about access to specialization. We've talked about access for a broader group of diversities across all types of diversity, including neurodiverse, everything, socioeconomic, and all of the ones that we talk about more and more. But what we haven't touched on is the fact that veterinary medicine or veterinary professionals have not been highly represented or even represented much at all in policymaking.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of marrying all of these worlds in your career trajectory or your imagined career trajectory, anticipated career trajectory. How can we start inspiring young veterinarians to look for places that maybe we haven't occupied before? Of course, in policy, because you and I both are kind of geeks about policy. But, you know, and you probably know of other gaps where there aren't enough veterinarians.
Well, it's really hard because even I found myself here, like, just by a fortunate combination of conversations with random people. So because it's never, ever advertised that or mentioned that we can take up space here, again, using this choice of words, I never imagined it before something started to click. And even now, like, if I hadn't found a job for FEE, I don't know what other options there were for me as a vet to come into policy with no training in policy, with no understanding about the institutions, for example. So I luckily found myself here. But even then, once you're already in veterinary policy, let's say you start interfacing with other stakeholders and other professions, and you see that even they're very perplexed because everyone is coming from political sciences. And so even if you're lobbying for the doctors, you're not a doctor, like a medical human doctor. And so it's a very peculiar to come with our set of tools. And we can bridge the gaps of not knowing how policy works and how public affairs should go. But it's on us to have the willingness to do that. And the visibility is a huge thing. But but again, that's where it starts. And we don't know this at all. So in my university, I had no idea. And even now when I go to some congresses and meet my professors again and I try to explain what I do, they're extremely confused. And it's really hard to explain to anyone what I do because policy is already such a black box of what does that mean? And then a vet to be in policy is even more confusing. So within the profession, outside of the profession, the complete absence of visibility and of understanding of this is a huge hurdle for anyone who could imagine themselves there potentially if they just know it was an option.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that is really hard to bridge. It'd be a point that this is something that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we can go. And what do we need to get there? Is it just connections? Is it just meeting the right people? Or can we actually properly prepare and maybe make this an option? Because that's very unfortunate that I then meet people like now and they're like, oh, this is so interesting.
Yeah.
So my answer is visibility, because that I really see like the first problem. And then of course, once visibility is there, you see it's an option. Okay, how do we get there? How can we teach vets to be in policy? How do vets get the skills to be in policy? And so this is somewhere where the residency, in my case, could come in.
Right.
But without the visibility, it's not even a goal. It's not even a vision.
Mm. And so now I'm going to be a little bit shameless. Because I think we have a lot. I know a lot of specialists and a lot of the specialty colleges are very motivated to contribute feedback toward policy, and they would really love to have a stronger voice there, but it's not realistic for them on a majority level to consider going into a career of policy. Mm-hmm. So that's I would guess that might be true for veterinarians across the board, or I should say generally speaking. How can our specialists and how can veterinarians get more involved in giving feedback to the policymakers? You know, I'll just throw an example on the floor here at our Congress this year. The question was asked, why aren't we consulted more mm-hmm. on policy? And the European Commission representative who was there said, like, well, you know, it has to be an exchange. How can we bring that exchange to more specialists, to more veterinarians, so that they feel heard?
So I think you asked me this because, you know, it's something I feel very strongly about, because we have such huge veterinary expertise in research and in finding data and having the information that could provide such positive change in so many policy areas of policy. But again, it's one of those communications issues that we mentioned. The way we communicate the science is meant for scientists, and it's not meant for policy. So there's kind of a gap there between the data and the policy, and that science diplomacy, that that translating it into recommendations and not just evidence is something we're not used to doing. So much of the academia and the research world is getting to the publication and then getting cited, and then your job is done. Sometimes it ends there, and that is such a missed opportunity. You have the evidence. What was that all for? To just put it in writing and to have this whole market of how many publications you got and the metrics? Like, there is so much power there that the whole reason I'm in policy is that I hope this can drive the impact that research, where research stops. So the evidence-led policy is right there in between, because the vets have all this knowledge and it's just not translated into legislation, into directives. And so training into, you don't need to understand policy so much as a vet to really make a contribution, but the framing is really important, just because policymakers will not read a scientific article.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is not the way to communicate. So to reframe that into something that is palatable and something that is that already has some deliverables and that shows the benefits and the impact of imbuing the knowledge that we uncover as vets is something we should imagine ourselves doing more and training potentially more for. But then also to have the audacity to be vets who, yes, we don't need to be working in Brussels and interfacing with policymakers to have a say. So there's other ways to get involved, even just on an occasional trip at a conference, trip at somewhere, or working groups that is, I assume, mostly compatible with having a full-time job during what building whatever that contribution is mm-hmm. that you want to put out into the world. But I think we're just shy and don't see our value in doing that. So we stay within our field. We're like, oh, no, but I don't have that, like, what I have to contribute is not that important that, you know, I would try to push policy. And it's like, why not? Because
mm-hmm.
if we're not doing it, then everyone else is doing it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think we sometimes have the idea that the commission should come to us.
Oh, yeah.
And in an ideal world, that might be true. But I think, you know, when you really start to look at governments, not only the European Commission, we won't talk about my government. When we really start to look at how governments function, they have so much to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much bureaucracy. We could take this to an international level, a national mm-hmm. level. I think it's probably applicable in so many places. Ideally, maybe they should come to us and ask for our input. The reality is they probably don't have the resources to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we worked together on a directive last year, which was literally called Have Your Say.
Well, that's the portal of the European Commission.
Right.
So that's as much as they will come to you as they will, yeah.
And even then, you have to be aware of when the deadline is, you have to be checking the website, right? So there is room for people to be involved, but it does require a little bit of proactiveness on their side.
Absolutely.
Is that a fair way of describing it?
It really does, and thank you for taking it out of just the EU space and also thinking at national level. Like, they will definitely not come to us, but there are avenues, and it is a lot a problem of taking that opportunity. And yes, I on concrete terms, I don't know how much impact this makes. I don't know how much to read everything that comes in, But this is an option we already have, and it's not that much work. And like taking aid of all the tools we currently have, having evidence on something that is relevant, that is open for consultation. Again, you need to know what's happening. For example, now we're just talking about you, of that data directive is being amended, that they're calling for evidence. So that's a big barrier. I have to say it's a big barrier, because before moving to Brussels, I had no idea this was the system in place.
Yeah.
So very fair. But if there is their awareness, providing input on something you're an expert about, and even just putting your name there, like, that's also visibility.
Yeah.
That's also visibility. There's so many citizens, so not even workplaces, NGOs, research institutes, citizens have the possibility to provide input to these things.
Maybe a place to leave this. We've talked about a lot of things, but one of the many available action items to people can get involved at any level, whether it's policy or just taking your seat at the table, whatever mm-hmm. table that is. But if you find a policy issue at a national or an EU level that you feel passionate about, that you would like to contribute to in some way, or that you would just like to feel heard on, and you don't have a network in mm-hmm. order to pursue how that might look, probably people could reach out to FEE just to ask, where do I look for this? Or they can reach out to me. I'll probably ask you if I don't know. But I mean, there are a few of us that have some networks in place, and we may not know the answer, but if we can just provide you with the next question.
But really, I mean, isn't that the point of where we both are now, like building that network and giving that voice? So if it's just an individual asking about, how does Have Your Say work? Or I found out, I'm really going on a limb, but like I found out this amazing solution that would fix biodiversity loss. Where do I put this? Like, who do I give this knowledge to? Like, even just imagining that we can, that vets can do that, that vets can have solutions and want to speak about solutions. And there are, you know, already organizations in place that are trying to give that voice to vets.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much gap there that is just due to not connecting. That I really hope we can bridge, because having already solutions and just not sharing them, again, 99% of the work done.
Yeah, yeah.
And 1% in communication that defies, that make, so 99% of the work is done, but 1% is communication. And the 1% of communication determines 99% of the success.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can make those connections, if we can, you know, create that visibility, create that knowledge sharing, go from evidence to policy, create pressure, show that vets are involved, show that vets have knowledge and they have value to contribute to, and women and youth, like putting all of this together, I think, you know, our job is done.
Yeah. And like you say, because we have some networks in crossing different spaces, in policy and lobbying and other unexpected areas, if those positions can facilitate access to a listener who is passionate about biodiversity or pandemia prevention or whatever solution that they have or whatever piece of information they want to contribute, if we can facilitate access to that, then I think we would both be happy to launch that.
So much. It's like the underlying invisible mission of
yeah.
every day. Like, of course, I can only do so much, but if it's a ripple and more ripples come through, I don't know, like there's so much power there. I wish we could do more with all that power.
Absolutely. So let's leave it with our listeners there that we're not looking for people necessarily who want to be full-time in policy. Happy to have you. But even if you just have one little idea that you want to share, it might not be little, so please share it. And, you know, we will do what we can to help facilitate your access to who can do something with it.
Absolutely.
On a policy level or wherever it needs to go.
100%.